I hope that you have completed the reading, so you're basically familiar with what we'll be going through today, which is the controversy concerning the relative order of events involved in the work of Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, the traditional view is that Ezra returned to Judea prior to Nehemiah. And this would place the return of Ezra in the seventh year of Artaxerxes I, around 458 or 457 BC, and Nehemiah in the 20th year in 445 or 444 BC. Now, how are these dates obtained? Well, they're obtained from just taking the text at face value. In Ezra chapter 7, in verse 7, it says, "There went up some of the children of Israel, the priests, the Levites, the singers, the porters, and the Nethinims, unto Jerusalem in the seventh year of Artaxerxes the king." And this is talking in the context of Ezra's return from Babylon to Jerusalem. So this is where we obtain 458. Now, there were three king Artaxerxes. However, for various technical reasons it's not necessary to get into here, it is impossible to date Nehemiah to any but Artaxerxes the First. And in his own book, it mentions that he came up in the 20th year. Of Artaxerxes and stayed until the 32nd and then went back to Persia and then came back again for a second term sometime later. So we have these dates as far as the years of the king Artaxerxes given by the relative books. That's simply a matter of going to the chronologies of the Persian kings and finding them what was the seventh year of Artaxerxes the First and what was the 20th year of Artaxerxes the First. Now, if we go along with the traditional view, we do have certain contributions from this view, or rather this view makes certain contributions to the discussion. The Bible does suggest that Ezra came first. It's suggested by the placement of the books. Ezra comes before Nehemiah in the canon. And even apparently when it was one scroll, it was Ezra, the portion of Ezra came first, and the material of Nehemiah came second. And we have no need to do any emendations to the text, which is always an advantage. But what makes it a controversy are the following things. We do have the peculiarity that the great work which Ezra had set himself, that of teaching the children of Israel who had resettled in Judah and Jerusalem the law, that great work, he doesn't begin it until at least 13 years later. Because it is evident from the text of the book of Nehemiah that Nehemiah was the governor in Jerusalem when Ezra read the law. And so at the very earliest, as I say, at the very earliest, Ezra could not have read the law until 445 B.C., when Nehemiah first returned. That's assuming that he read it in the very first year that Nehemiah was there. Now, Nehemiah was there for 12 years. He could have read it any time during that 12-year period. And then, of course, Nehemiah went back to Persia. And then after an unspecified interval, he came back. And maybe Ezra didn't read the law until he came back the second time. That's also possible. So it could be many, 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 many more years, more than just 13, before Ezra actually gets the law read. And so this represents a problem. What was Ezra doing for all that time? If he came back before Nehemiah, what explains the failure to accomplish his commission? I mean, he was commissioned by the king to do that. Why does he fail to complete that commission for at least 13 years? What is he doing there in Judea? Sitting on and sucking his thumb or what? You see, this is the problem. Also, it would appear that Ezra's reform must have been a failure, and it must have been renewed for some reason the days of Nehemiah. And this represents to many scholars a problem, if that was true. And we find that Nehemiah, in his own work, makes absolutely no mention of Ezra having been there before him. He makes no mention of Ezra's pioneering work. Even where Nehemiah has to address at least one problem that is the same. Which problem does Nehemiah have to address that Ezra had already addressed? Which of the problems did Ezra grapple with first, apparently unsuccessfully, if he came back before Nehemiah? Yeah. Because it's clear that Ezra did that immediately upon his return. But immediately when he got to Jerusalem, he began to fast and mourn these intermarriages, and then began to break them up immediately upon his return. And yet, when Nehemiah gets there, he faces the same problem. And that's another reason why, again, as I say, it makes Ezra's reform apparently a failure. First of all, he doesn't do the main part of it, reading the law, for at least 13 years. And then the thing that he did start with, the mixed marriages, didn't stick. And so a lot of scholars say this is not the way the tradition holds up Ezra. Therefore, it is impossible that Ezra returned before Nehemiah. And therefore, this traditional framework is rejected because of these problems. And so what obtains is a rather extreme scenario which places Nehemiah coming before Ezra. That's in itself is not extreme, but this is. It leaves Nehemiah returning in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the First, because, as I said, for various technical reasons, that's the only year in which he could have returned. But it places Ezra's return still in the 7th year of Artaxerxes. But instead of Artaxerxes the First, it presumes that Ezra returned in the 7th year of Artaxerxes the Second. Remember that the Bible doesn't say first or second. It never does. It only gives the names of kings, never gives their numbers. So therefore, this is on the face of it not impossible. There's nothing in the text that would implicitly say it couldn't be the 7th year of Artaxerxes II. It also makes the following contributions. You end up with a more logical sequence of events. Now, what do I mean, a more logical sequence of events? Let's look at the matter in this fashion. And you'll see what I mean. First of all, Ezra mentions a wall in Jerusalem. In Ezra chapter 9, verse 9. Let's take a look at that. This is a prayer which Ezra is giving in chapter 9. We read the beginning of the prayer in verse 6. It says, O my God, I am ashamed and blush to lift up my face to you, my God. For our iniquities are increased over our head, our trespasses grown up unto the heavens. Since the days of our fathers have we been in a great trespass unto this day. And for our iniquities have we, our kings and our priests, been delivered into the hands of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, to spoil, to confusion of face as it is this day. Now for a little space, grace has been showed from the Lord our God to leave us a remnant to escape, to give us a nail in his holy place, that our God may lighten our eyes and give us a little reviving in our bondage. For we were bondmen, yet our God has not forsaken us in our bondage, but has extended mercy to us in the sight of the kings of Persia, to give us a reviving, to set up the house of our God, and to repair the desolations thereof, and to give us a wall in Judah and in Jerusalem. So Ezra is giving God thanks for the wall in Jerusalem. But, as we know, it was Nehemiah who built the wall. And so you seem to have Ezra giving thanks for the wall before it was built. Because if we follow the traditional date of 458, 457, and Nehemiah's 445, 444, this is before Nehemiah, there seems to be a giving of thanks for that wall. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It obviously would make more sense if Nehemiah has built the wall and Ezra gives thanks for it afterwards. And so therefore, Ezra giving thanks for the wall in Jerusalem in 398 makes more sense than giving thanks before it could be built. That's what I mean about a more logical sequence. Now, the second of these points relates to the fact that Ezra apparently finds the city populated. Yet we know from the book of Nehemiah that Jerusalem was almost totally abandoned or lacking in population. And so again, because of the lack of the wall. And so therefore, again, it makes more sense for Ezra to find the city populated if he came back after Nehemiah. Now, the third point is that Ezra, when he comes to Jerusalem, here he is, a distinguished scribe from Babylon and a priest of a very distinguished priestly line. He is assigned specific housing in Jerusalem, and he is given the chamber of Yohanan. That's Yohanan. Yohanan in the temple is assigned. We know that in the days of Nehemiah, Yohanan was the grandson of the high priest. And so therefore, and he was later himself the high priest, in time. Therefore, it is suggested by the scholars embracing this theory that this makes more sense if Yochanan, who was the grandson of Nehemiah's high priest and was high priest in 398, is the one who was meant here. Yochanan, the high priest, assigns Ezra his own chamber. But this is more logical. Now, there are certain weaknesses, however, of this view. The Bible still, by the order of the books, suggests that Ezra came first. That in itself is not 100% critical, because the order of books in the Bible is not always chronological. I mean, it's just a suggestion. It's not necessarily demands that chronological order. Something much more serious is this, is that there's no way for Nehemiah and Ezra to have been in Jerusalem at the same time. It's just not possible. That's why I say they're not contemporaries. There's no way, if we take this Reformed view, for Ezra and Nehemiah to have been in Jerusalem at the same time. Why? Because there's no way Nehemiah could still have been the governor of Judea in 398. We have the name of the individual who was the governor of Judea at that time, and it's not Nehemiah. Now, why is that a critical problem? Because in the book of Nehemiah, in chapter 8, where Ezra is reading the law, it indicates that Nehemiah was present. In Nehemiah 8, verse 9, says, Nehemiah, which is the Tirshatha, or governor, and Ezra the priest, the scribe, and the Levites that taught the people, said to the people, this day is holy to the Eternal your God. Mourn not, nor weep, for all the people wept when they heard the words of the law, because they knew how far away they were from keeping it. It was a very distressful thing. It's like Josiah, when he discovered the book of the law in the temple. He began to mourn because he saw how far off track they were. So this is a specific reference to Nehemiah being present, and this is not possible given this rearrangement. Now, what do the scholars do about this problem? Well, they just say, we just have an historical gloss here in the text, that originally the name Nehemiah did not appear, and it was entered in later through scribal error, that he was present at this reading of the law. Also, a significant problem for this arrangement is a document which is known as the Passover Papyrus, which can clearly be dated to 419 B.C. Now, what we need to note, first of all, is that since it can be dated to 419 B.C., does the document date from before or after Ezra's presumed return to Jerusalem? Let's take a look at that and lock in on that. That's very important. Which is it? Is the document before Ezra's putative return or after? This should be very easy for you to see. Just compare the dates. It's before. 419 B.C. is prior to 398, right? So this document, whatever it contains, is earlier than the time Ezra presumably went back to Jerusalem. Now, this is deemed to be a very significant weakness in this theory because of the contents of this particular document. It is a letter, a copy, I should say, of a letter written from the Persian emperor to the garrison, the Persian garrison, stationed at Aswan in Egypt. Now, Aswan is located in the southern borders of Egypt. Now, this garrison of soldiers was almost exclusively Jewish by religion. I get more and more tangled the more and more I move. Now, the document coming from the Persian king states that the Jews of the garrison at Aswan must be certain to observe the Passover and days of unleavened bread in the proper manner, being specifically instructed by the Persian king to be sure to do this. And that if there is any doubt as to the procedures to be used, they should consult with the scribes in Jerusalem, who are the experts on the law, and be guided by the example of what is done in Jerusalem. Now do you see why this is considered a problem for this theory of the dating of Ezra? Now, and the scribal schools established in Jerusalem for them to have become the headquarters of, you know, knowing what's right. In other words, he doesn't refer them to the scribes and the experts living in Babylon who know what should be done. He refers them to the scribes as the experts in Jerusalem who know what to be done. So they have already been established in Jerusalem as experts, you know, in the law. But that was a major part of the work of Ezra. So that's already been done, apparently. This Passover papyrus presumes that that work has already been done by 419. And that's a very serious weakness, then, to this theory that Ezra returned in 398. Is there anybody that doesn't see that? Okay, you know.
I see the weakness. I was just wondering if you could repeat the town from
the pardon? Aswan. Aswan is, you know, where the high dam is in Egypt today. Yeah. Because it mentions the year of the Persian king, so therefore it's no doubt what year it was. As I say, this is a very accurately dated piece of material. And as I said, he is referring them to Jerusalem, where the scribes and the experts in the keeping of the law are located, and they should be guided in case they have any doubts as to how to proceed. They should follow that example. And that's part of Ezra's work, which seems to have already been done. Okay, what has emerged then, primarily because of these two problems, that there were many scholars that weren't too happy with the answer that you've got a historical gloss in the text that let the name Nehemiah creep in. They didn't think that was too possible. And especially because of the problem of the Passover papyrus, a third alternative was presented. Yes? Well, in the sense that if Ezra comes afterwards, then all the political and physical reestablishment of things has been done. Ezra comes, there's no 13-year gap. As soon as he comes, he reads the law. He gets right to work, and it gets done. You see. And he doesn't fail at his breaking up the mixed marriages. It's Nehemiah who failed to make it stick. You see. Ezra gets it done. Now, the reason for preferring that is that the Jewish tradition tends to honor Ezra far above Nehemiah. In fact, in the Jewish tradition, Nehemiah is sort of, he's given some credit for his work, but he's not anywhere near considered to be the figure that Ezra is. So it's kind of hard to see Ezra as a failure given that tradition, according to the scholars. Now, a sort of a compromise view has been proposed in this fashion. It still leaves Nehemiah returning first, but it places the return of Ezra in the 37th year of Artaxerxes I. Now, why and how does it arrive at this? Well, as you can see, it assumes that the text needs a slight emendation. What it assumes is that a number has dropped out of the text. Now, why should a number have dropped out of the text? Well, it's not uncommon for things to get dropped when you've got a repetitive series of figures to copy. And in Hebrew, the 37th year is Shloshim V'Sheva Shana. Well, let me just... Now, I know you can't all read Hebrew, but the key point is that each of these words begins with the same letter, and that it is possible, because there's also the same letter in the middle of this word, that a scribe in copying neglected to copy this word, and this word got left out, and it got left Sheva Shana, seventh year. This is 30th and seventh year. So by careless copying of this repetitive, each word beginning with the same symbol, one of them got dropped. Now, as I said, this is not without precedent in the text of the Bible. For example, I gave you this before in 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 1. You have an obvious dropping out of the text, because when you read it in the Hebrew, it makes no sense. And I'm quoting from one of the more modern translations. A footnote says the original numbers in this verse, talking about 1 Samuel 13, verse 1, have apparently been lost in transmission. One way to understand the verse is Saul was blank years old when he began to reign, and he reigned blank in 2 years over Israel. Another suggestion renders it, Saul was 1 and blank years old when he began to reign, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, he chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel. And this is a very similar situation, especially with the second suggestion, that he was 1 and blank years old, because that'd be like the major part of the number dropped out, just like the major part dropped out here, according to this theory. I mentioned before that one of the Catholic Bibles leaves it as Saul was a child of 1 year when he began to reign. And the footnote there is, that is, he was good and like an innocent child. And for 2 years he continued in that innocency. Because, you know, those translators did not want to admit the possibility that something had dropped out. And makes a reading which is really ridiculous. And that's why scholars today generally accept that a number certainly dropped out of the text in 1 Samuel 13:1. As I say, what then would be so impossible about a number having dropped out here? But what is gained from this emendation, which is a very, very small emendation? Two things. We are left with what apparently is a more logical series of events. That Nehemiah returns first and builds the wall, so when Ezra comes, he gives thanks for it. That Nehemiah comes and finds Jerusalem almost totally abandoned, and then populates it, so when Ezra comes, he finds it populated. And that Yochanan is, a significance enough to give up his room for Nehemiah when he returns. Now, it also overcomes the initial problem of the strong reform view putting Ezra after Nehemiah. It permits them to be contemporaries. Now, how does this permit Ezra and Nehemiah to be contemporaries? Well, let's look at a few chronological things here for a minute. In the text of the book of Nehemiah, it says that Nehemiah came in the 20th year, and he remained until the 32nd. In other words, he remained for 12 years. So until what year was Nehemiah in Jerusalem? Just subtract 12. Okay. Then he returned to Susa, the capital. But then the book of Nehemiah says, it doesn't say how much longer, how much later, but at a later time, Nehemiah came a second time to Jerusalem. We don't know the exact date. It's not given in the text. It just says he came after a period of time when he spent in Susa, in the capital of Persia. He returned again to Jerusalem. They are presuming that this was in the 37th year, in 428, and that he brought Ezra with him. In other words, that Nehemiah had come to see that his work of physical restoration was not sufficient in itself, that people needed spiritual reconstruction also. And so he brings Ezra with him. Not directly that they traveled together, because they came from different places also. Nehemiah came from the Persian capital, and Ezra came from Babylon, but that they arrived at about the same time in Jerusalem, and that's when Ezra did his work. This theory, which probably today among I would say most scholars, this is probably the one they would prefer, is that you do need to amend the text in order to accept this view. Now, why is that such a big deal? We have the example of 1 Samuel 13:1, an exactly parallel situation. Why should that be such a worrisome thing? Yes. See, it's the whole approach which is very suspect. That's what Mr. Knopfler says. In the case of 1 Samuel 13:1, as he says, it's obvious something dropped out. The grammar itself betrays the fact that something must have dropped out. In this particular text in Ezra, there is nothing in the grammar that it makes it obvious that a number has dropped out. You are presuming one did for the sake of your convenience of your theory. Now, if one uses that approach to the Bible, one then can find things dropping out of the text anywhere one wants to have them drop out. As long as, you know, you can't just do it just anywhere. But I mean, anywhere where the grammar will permit you to look at something dropping out, you could presume something dropping out if it suits your convenience. In other words, you've got no control under such methodology. It's a very dangerous approach to use. You see, to hang everything on that, because everything hangs on that. Without the assumption that a number has dropped out, this whole theory just falls apart. It just doesn't have a chance of existing. The only theory that stands on its own merits, based on the reading of the text, is the second theory. That's the only alternative theory that stands on its own merits. But of course, that requires, you know, a gloss in the book of Nehemiah, and it also has a problem of that papyrus, the Passover papyrus. That's why scholars have drifted to this as a way of still keeping Ezra coming second, but avoiding the serious problems of the second theory. Now, why should we care? Why should we care one way or another? Why don't we just throw up our hands and say, well, this is one of those chronological arguments. Who cares? What difference does it make? The sun will rise tomorrow anyway. Should it bother us which view prevails? Interesting. Very interesting. It should. We should have a very strong vested interest in seeing the first view prevail. Why? Mike? Well, it's always safer to take the text at face value. And indeed, it's not only traditional scholars that say we should do that. I was trained in part under a man who is very much a modern critical scholar. And yet one thing he says about the text, he says, don't rush to amend the text when you don't understand it the way it is now. There may be reasons that something is in the text that doesn't seem to make sense. Don't always assume it's an error, a gloss, or something's dropped. In fact, he's been proved right more than once by saying, wait, and we will see, and as evidence comes to light, which may throw some light on this obscure passage. One of the passages that he was ridiculed for supporting is a passage in the book of Kings, I think it is, that says that Israel recovered a certain piece of land from Judah. And it makes no sense because the piece of land is to the north of Israel. How could Judah, which is to the south, have controlled the piece of land to the north of Israel? It made no sense. And so everybody was rushing to amend the text and make it readable, and make it make sense geographically. And he argued for a long time in print that, you know, the text seems to not have any problems that we can see with it. It looks like it's fine. We don't understand what it means, but let's just wait. And we discovered not too many years later that there was a second kingdom of Judah that was located in the north, even further north, that owned that disputed piece of territory. And that's why the text as it read made sense. But you see, it's interesting that as a modern critical scholar, he has this tremendous respect for the integrity of the text. Mainly, I think, because his earliest training was in the mechanics of textual transmission, and he felt, you know, that this thing has been preserved so beautifully, let's just not play games with it for our own convenience when we don't understand things. Let's just wait and see if later events will illuminate these things we don't understand. Anyway, the whole thing rides on this amendment to the text. But why should we uphold the traditional view? What depends upon it? Well, maybe you've forgotten. So let's go back and put this on the screen again. Why do we have a vested interest in preferring this view? That Ezra came back, problematic though they may be, in 458 or 457. Exactly. The 70 weeks prophecy is begun from the time when we believe Ezra came back. If we move Ezra, then we have to move the beginning of the 70 weeks prophecy, or we have to assign it to Nehemiah, since he came back before Ezra. And that means we start counting the 70 weeks from 445, and one ends up at a considerably different place when one finishes, where nothing of any consequence happened. So it appears that for the 70 weeks prophecy to function, we have to have Ezra returning in 458 and 457. Well, if this is the case, we need to examine again these weaknesses and see if we can find some logical, reasonable explanations that would take care of them. Why is it that Ezra would apparently do nothing about reading the law and teaching the law for at least 13 years after his return? We have to come up with some sort of an explanation that reasonably answers that problem. Why is it that the Jewish tradition holds Ezra's work as being of equal rank with Moses, holds him up at the same level of almost sainthood, if you would, when apparently, if this is true, he was a failure for so many years? And why can we find any possible reason why Nehemiah's work makes no reference to Ezra's prior work? Anyway, why don't you think on those things? And next time I will give you a reconstruction which takes the traditional view and will provide some explanations for these weaknesses. See if you can come up with some way of accounting for it. I suggest that you read, as well as, of course, these problems. How could he give thanks for a wall that isn't yet built? And why is the city populated in Ezra's day when he comes back and unpopulated in Nehemiah's? And this business of the chamber of Yochanan. This is even easier to work out. Be able to find satisfactory explanations for that. Especially this here. I suggest you may want to read Ezra chapter 9 carefully. And then you might find the roots for some of this being reconciled, as well as for at least number 1. If you read it carefully. There's also another scripture or chapter you might want to look at, but I don't want to even mention it. But if you think of it, it's in the book of Ezra. You might find that chapter, a large section of it, very instructive too.